In the book of Matthew, the faithful are called upon, among other things, to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and visit the imprisoned. Joshua Dubler, a scholar of religions, has heeded at least the latter, and then some. For 6 years, he studied the chapel-going men of Greaterford Maximum Security Prison in Pennsylvania, involving himself in every facet of religious life at the facility, from debates over scripture authorship to weekly worship services to the daily frustrations of being a spiritual man in a less-than-sacred place. He recounts 1 week of his time there in his book, Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased to bring him to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Early in the book, you describe Greaterford Prison as arguably the most religiously eclectic sliver of real estate in the history of the world. More than Queens and more than other prisons?
A bit of hyperbole there. But as far as having a wide variety of people with widely divergent beliefs sharing the very small, cramped quarters, that's what struck me. You have on a weekly basis 12 officially recognized denominations that have, I think, something like 55 worship services, Bible studies, musical group rehearsals. So the diversity is staggering.
But most of the things you describe involve the so-called Judeo-Christian tradition. No mention of Buddhists or Hindus and Wiccans seem to be getting short shrift.
Most definitely, the religious diversity is according to a somewhat narrow template. The history by which we moved from having, as recently as 50 years ago, you could have been a Protestant or a Catholic or a Jew in Greaterford, and now you can be 12 things. But that's been by fits and by starts, and always with the courts and administrators trying to accommodate things that are less conventional from what they know.
Greaterford is a maximum security prison, which means it's filled with some really bad guys. How many prisoners are practicing religion, and how many attend chapel services on a regular basis?
So roughly 3,500 men are housed at Greaterford, and I would say that, you know, over the course of a month, maybe a quarter of those people frequent the chapel.
How does that compare with the general population of the United States?
I couldn't tell you. The book is pretty fiercely particularistic. Oh, do you mean in terms of the general, how many people
attendance,
go to church?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question.
But so one quarter, that means three quarters you had no contact with at all.
Not exactly. I mean, the 6 years that you cite is actually two different time periods. The research that when I was getting my doctoral dissertation that went into this book was over about 2 years when I was in the chapel. After that, I stuck around Greaterford because Villanova has a BA program, and I taught in that program for a number of years. And there I got access to a widely different set of subcultures.
But you spent 6 years on and off at Greaterford, and you chose to document just 1 week in detail. Why was that?
It actually is born, the structure of the book is born as an experiment fostered by the religious diversity, right? Because you have this weekly slate of schedules where you have this range of religious practices. And so it seemed as if that might be a good structure for getting at these very tensions you're identifying between diversity and constraint. So I did it as an experiment. And by the second day in the week, one of the central characters is taken away to the hole. And so it serves as a kind of an event. And for whatever reason, I knew around that time that that would be the structure of the book.
That was Saeed, one of the Muslim chaplain's clerks, who was trafficking contraband?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, he was accused of trafficking contraband.
Yes, he was.
So what would that mean for his reputation among the religious at Greaterford and among the chaplains?
I don't
know. If they think that he was committing a crime at the same time that he was participating in religious services.
As one of the correctional officers says about Saeed, you know, even if he was doing something, that doesn't necessarily make him religiously insincere. As far as his reputation goes, you know, there are many different factions. I think that some would have held him in high regard and some less so.
Were you given a lot of access, but only to the chapel, or were you permitted elsewhere as well?
I was shocked at the access I received.
Because religion occurs outside of a chapel.
Mm-hmm. Which I make room for in the book, but obliquely. I mean, the book is pretty committed to engaging what I'm in a position to engage and leaving aside the things I'm not necessarily in a position to engage.
Well, did the prisoners trust you? After all, you are a self-described secular Jew in a prison where most of the prisoners are Protestants and Muslims.
Right. Going back to the access question, excuse me, I was essentially given carte blanche, but the culture of the prison is that unless you have business explicitly on the cell blocks, you don't really go there. So I kind of assimilated that unwritten edict. As far as how they received me, they found me a bit far out. I think many of them enjoyed my presence. Not a lot happens there. I was an eager, enthusiastic person who was kind of there to play. In a way, my Jewishness rendered me intelligible in a way that if I advertised the full depth of my secular agnosticism, I would have freaked them out.
On the other hand, that allowed you to not be allied with one group rather than another. There must have been some Jewish prisoners as well.
There were Jewish prisoners, and I felt a kind of commonality with them. I was most certainly a free person who was there from the outside, and that marked me in certain ways. The men were incredibly gracious with me and open with me, and the book would have been nothing had they not had that willingness.
You say that you wrote this book in part to dispel stereotypes about religious prisoners. What stereotypes in particular?
It seems that the intersection of how we think about religion and how we think about prisoners in our culture, they're two kind of natural knee-jerk assumptions. On the one hand, if we think about religion as a fixed state of interiority, what one believes deep in their heart, and we think about prisoners as defining them by virtue of their crimes, of what they have done, then we necessarily conclude that that when they're doing their religious stuff, they're really just faking it.
And they're faking it to impress the parole board?
Yeah, for those that are eligible for parole, the central characters are all serving life without the possibility of parole. Lifers aren't eligible for parole in Pennsylvania. But for whatever kind of minute trappings of material advantage that they can gain is what the assumption would be.
Well, some of them, of course, come in with a strong sense of religiosity, but there's also another stereotype of the jailhouse convert. That prisoners only become serious about religion because they have nothing else to live for. And you call that into question as well.
Exactly. I mean, the former stereotype I call the bad man of religion, and the latter I call the poor man of religion. That being a kind of more secularist, maybe Marxist assumption that, religion is the opiate of the masses. Religion is what, you cling to your guns and your religion, as Obama famously said, because you don't have anything else. The contempt that one feels for the bad man and the pity that one feels for the poor man are in some ways go hand in hand.
My guest is Joshua Dubler, who's written a book called Down in the Chapel: Religious Life in an American Prison. To what extent do these stereotypes, these preconceived notions, live within the prison itself? Do guards and chaplains view their prisoners with suspicion?
It's a great question. The chaplains are, they try to be charitable. They couldn't do their work, they say, if they really saw these men as convicts or as criminals. I mean, I think the most vicious tend to be the prisoners themselves, who these judgments of contempt and pity that, they pass them over one another. Most people there would, in the chapel, I think, they present themselves as trying to do good in the world, but they're quick to think that their fellow prisoner is full of it.
And you coin a term for the way that prisoners are viewed. A religious inmate is a bad man of religion.
Yeah, right. That goes back to the assumption that, I generally think that our public conversation about religion is a little bit impoverished. And we tend to think about religion as, what someone believes in their heart of hearts. That never made sense to me because I was raised by essentially Orthodox Jewish agnostics. So one of the things I'm trying to do is to widen the possibilities of what religion could be.
Now, do you think it's also because we think a person who's that bad can never really be good?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or that religion isn't the way that person will see the true light and improve himself?
It's funny you say true light, right? Because I think that there are two kind of foundational criminological ways of thinking about crime in this country, and they go back to the beginnings of the penitentiary. One we would call Quaker environmentalism. Essentially, you fell in with the wrong crowd. We're going to put you in prison so you can commune with your maker and the goodness in you will glow anew. And the other is a kind of Calvinist fatalism, which is, you know, you're a bad seed. And definitely we've been in an era for the past 40 years where the Calvinist fatalist wing of thinking about crime is predominated. And so we tend to throw people out and we tend to define them by virtue of their crimes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the chapel itself? How do prisoners wind up being able to go there? Can anyone go there? Because my sense of a maximum security prison is you're locked up in your cell and then once in a while they let you out and you go out to the yard. Then, or maybe you go to eat and maybe even eat in your own cell, and that's it.
There aren't that many places to go, it's true. The central characters, in general, prisoners, unless it's, you know, the Sunday morning Protestant service, Friday Juma, Saturday night Catholic service, prisoners need a slip to go to the chapel. The exception to that rule is the chapel workers themselves. So 15 people, men who live at Greaterford, work in the chapel as clerks and as janitors. And so they're really the central characters of the book because they're in there day in, day out, and they're the people that I got to know the best.
In the 1990s, wasn't the chapel also open for the families of the imprisoned?
So one of the stories that I tell is about the way that religious practice has changed over the years. And a key moment in that is 1995, when Tom Ridge, who goes on to be Bush's first director of Homeland Security, becomes governor of Pennsylvania. They really revamp criminal justice in Pennsylvania and make time a lot tougher, make sentences a lot longer, and they put serious restrictions on the chapel, restrictions that are still being felt tremendously today.
Now, we mentioned earlier that there are a lot of different religions here. Some religions are viewed with a bit of skepticism by other religions. Most religions present themselves as the true faith. But I would think that Wiccans would have a real problem getting a little foothold in a chapel like this.
There's a guy who's a Wiccan who appears in the first chapter, and I put him there because there's no place for him in the chapel. While the federal court decisions recognize Wiccanism as legitimate religion, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and the head of chaplaincy at Greaterford sees no reason they should have a corporate prayer. So he does all of his religious stuff in his cell. But when I asked him if he felt excluded, he laughed and he said that for him to worship in a Christian chapel would be like a Jew keeping kosher in a pork factory. So he was more than happy to be excluded.
Because he really, in the end, he'd be out of place in a another religion's place of worship.
And I think he was also calling attention to what you were suggesting earlier about the way that as much as there's great diversity, they all exist according to a narrow Judeo-Christian template.
Now, you mentioned most of these people are serving life without any possibility of parole. Is there any sense of people rehabilitating themselves?
Until the 1990s, there was a real chance at commutation, but the rules were changed, and so maybe two people have had their sentence commuted in the last decade. That said, the idea of rehabilitation, which is usually expressed in the language of transformation, the idea that these men have about themselves, that they were something and now they're something different, that's a very live idea.
What about people proselytizing to convert you to their religion? Do you see a lot of that?
You know, it's officially against the rules, but the Jehovah's Witnesses go cell by cell. Among my core relationships,
used to be in the Nation of Islam was seen as having a strong presence in the prisons. No longer the case?
One of the big surprises is what the version of Islam is that predominates today. So I assume many of your listeners, when they think about Islam in prisons, they think about Malcolm X, they think about a kind of political, sociological, religious orientation. And those guys still exist, but it's very out of fashion. The dominant mode of Islam, men who identify primarily as Salafi, are much more legalistic and they're anti-political.
What about all of the neo-Nazi types that we hear about in prisons? Are any of them religious?
There are allegedly a couple at Greaterford. They don't come to the chapel.
One of the prisons, Mamda, is keen on reciting a line from Dostoevsky that the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. Did you find that to be true with regard to religion?
you know, the religion is a piece of it, and the prison is another piece of it. I mean, I do think that the First Amendment right of free religious exercise is one of our sacred freedoms. That said, to find it within this monument of American unfreedom at a time when we have, 2.2 million people incarcerated, it's, ironic at best.
Although many of the people who are incarcerated who probably should be let out of prison are not at prisons like Greatorfitt. We're talking mostly about people who have killed, aren't we?
Yes, but in many cases, a number of the central... So the central character, Baraka, is there for homicide, a crime that he claims he didn't commit. He's been in prison longer than I've been alive. There are a number of the central characters who are serving life in prison for crimes they committed when they were 16 and 17 years old.
And Human Rights Watch is calling for a reevaluation. They say that even if you were sentenced to life without a possibility of parole, when you reach a certain age, it's unlikely that you will be any danger to society. You have mellowed. You have probably totally rehabilitated with religion or not. And so we should reconsider that.
I don't think Antonin Scalia...
Many of these people are actually physically incapacitated as well.
I don't think Antonin Scalia would find it at all compelling, but Canada, Germany, France, these other countries are not in the practice of taking people who are teenagers and putting them in prison for the rest of their lives.
Joshua Dubler is assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester, co-author of Bang, Thud, World Spirit from a Texas Schoolbook Depository. The book we've been talking about is Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.